Hello, everybody. My name is Christopher Thomas Plant.
I'm Russ Frushtick.
And welcome to the Resties, where we celebrate the best of the rest on Festivus. No, that didn't rhyme as well as I thought it would.
Festivus.
Festivus. There, now it's closer. Every episode, we get a little closer to perfection.
That was sort of like the M&M 4-inch door hinge rhyme that everyone makes a big deal about, which is to say, not the best.
I appreciate that you continue to let me try. This week, we're talking about Unsighted, which is just an absolutely fantastic game. I can't wait to tell you more about. Plus, we'll be talking about some new Game Pass gems, including a brand new game called XO1. And as always, we'll talk about what else we've been playing at the end of our show with our recommendations of the week. First, Unsighted. I realize this one might take a little bit of an explanation because it's not your Halo Infinite. It's not your Resident Evil Village. It doesn't have, you know, a giant marketing campaign. So I'll try my best to sell it to you before we throw it to a short break. Unsighted is kind of a Zelda Metroidvania type game about a meteor that has crashed into Earth, and it contains... And I know if you're anti-fantasy, I can already feel those eyes rolling. Just bear with me. Contains anima, and this resource radiates energy that grants robots sentient life. And of course, because people are terrible in science fiction, especially, and you know, and sometimes in the real world, humans are like, no, we're shutting this down. Except for one doctor who's like, I'm gonna work with the robots. We're gonna fight back against humanity. We're going to protect this precious resource, and we're going to make it so that these robots who just discovered what it means to be alive can keep doing that. The video game. Did I do it?
I guess so, yeah. I wouldn't have started necessarily with the lore to bring people in, but that's fine.
It's good lore.
It's a good game. It's not bad. It's a lot to sort of take in early on. So
I wanted to get it out there to begin with because now we can get to the meat and potatoes.
Sure.
You know? Okay. So we'll do that right after the break. Okay. So I started playing this game after listening to friends of the show, Into the Ether. They had an episode with Dom Nero from, I believe he's at Esquire. Well, I apologize, Dom, if it's GQ somehow. But they had a great episode talking about this, and Dom was particularly passionate about it and said that this was probably his game of the year. And immediately I was like, well, I need to play this. If there is a game that I effectively had only kind of seen rumblings about on Twitter, getting that sort of praise from people I trust. And... wow, I'm glad I did that because I can feel it skyrocketing up my own game of the year list as I kind of progress through it. What is your reaction to it? Because when I threw it to you, I as someone who doesn't fully get the difference between Metroidvania and Zelda games, I was really interested to hear what you would think of this at first blush.
Sure. So I originally played it right on launch day when it came out. Because it was on Game Pass, I was like, oh, what's this? I'll download it and give it a shot. And I'd been hearing some good rumblings about it, but I picked it up. I played it for probably a half hour right when it launched and was not immediately gripped by it. You know, Plant sort of alluded to this in the intro. There's a lot of lore. There's a lot of, info dump at the beginning. And my tolerance for that is pretty low, generally speaking. Not to mention the fact that it kind of was reminding me of a game that I also didn't super care for, although I know a lot of people did, which was CrossCode, which was a game we've talked about on Besties before. It was like a weird meta MMO, but not really an MMO game, top-down like RPG thing. And this has the same perspective as CrossCode. It has some of the same like puzzle stuff as CrossCode. So I was initially like kind of put off by it. But the more I have played since then, Plant came was like, no, you really have to play it. So like several weeks after launch, I came back to it and it definitely did end up clicking for me way more than it did initially. So I have really been enjoying it. Whether it's a Metroidvania or not, I don't know. What are labels? Who cares?
It's a game that borrows, I feel like, very joyfully from a whole bunch of different things, and does it not in the way where, you know, you can sometimes you play a game and you're like, oh, they really wanted to go out and make this type of game, where this feels like, oh, they had a thing that they wanted to create, and then wherever they saw inspiration, they just grabbed it and threw it into the recipe.
Yeah, so just to like talk about what the, you know, we've talked about the lore before, but what the actual like minute to minute of the game is, Plant mentioned Zelda. It is very similar to like Link to the Past era Zelda, which is to say you're dropped into this very large open world, and you're given this objective of, hey, here are five crystals scattered around the world. Go get them to save all the robots from turning, you know, losing their sentience, basically. And to that extent, like, you have a lot of freedom about where you go and what you do next, whether it's, hey, someone's like, oh, you could go here and someone has some gear for you, or you could go directly to your objective, or you could do a different dungeon instead of like the starting dungeon they suggest. It is very open, but the minute-to-minute of, like, moving through the world does feel very Zelda. There's a lot of, like, switch puzzles and block puzzles and stuff like that that allows you to sort of, like, progress through the world, but also that's paired with what I think is better than those early Zelda games is a combat system that is, like, very involved and, you know, with dodging and building up a combo meter and
it's
and,
so crunchy.
And stamina and stuff like that. It's very soulsy in some ways. It feels great. It's a really great combat system.
Something I love about the combat in this game is you do have to parry. And as someone who's bad, I'm just bad at the hyper-reflexive games. I really admire the Souls games. I could kind of get into them. Sekiro, I'm just not good enough. I don't know. My reflexes aren't there. But this game, the cue that you need to parry is very forgiving, and the window that you can parry inside of is also very forgiving. So I found that I was playing the game to parry. You were really rewarded for parrying an attack and then diving in after that. And I quickly realized that is the way to do combat in this game.
Yeah.
And it just feels very fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think the combat and the minute-to-minute stuff is very, very good. I don't think it's why it is on so many Game of the Year lists, or at least in contention. I think that's more to do with the narrative stuff, which I guess we can get into now. Certainly the most unique aspect of the game is not the stuff that Plant was talking about early on, but actually the idea that every NPC, every talking NPC basically that you meet, when you talk to them, they have a timer, and if that amount of time passes in in-game time, so if their timer says 300 hours and in in-game time 300 hours passes, which is much, much faster than real time, that character, well, I mean, Plant, you can explain it.
Yeah, they go unsighted. That's where the title of the game comes from. And what that means is these robots that briefly gain sentience from this, like, meteor crashing into Earth, lose sentience, and they become effectively, like, zombies.
Yeah.
Craving the resource, the anima that gave them life. So they're the creatures that you're fighting.
It brings to mind... in the Souls games, there's always those moments where, like, the person that is chilling in your hub world at some point goes, blanking on the term they use, hollowed. They go hollowed.
Yeah.
And at that point, they're more or less an enemy that loses all, you know, you basically have to fight them or they'll kill you. So that happens, but for every NPC in the game, pretty wild.
Yeah, and when Fresh says every NPC, this is like all of your friends. These are the shopkeepers. These are just random people passing in the street, of which there are many. This is even the like fairy robot tutorial like person.
The equivalent of like Navi in a Zelda game.
Yeah, any of them will just die. And what makes this particularly tragic for your character is, in kind of a JRPG fashion, you have lost your memory when you are starting this game. But gradually you realize that you had very, very deep relationships with most people in this area, that you were a pretty key figure and that you had romantic relationships, that you had very serious friendships. And just as you are learning about these relationships, you're also having to decide kind of who lives and who dies. Or you, because you also have a clock ticking down. So you could, you know, be extremely generous with all of the anima that you collect as you complete the game, but you could go inside it, and then that's just game over. Like, that's it. Which might not be for everybody, so that's why we should also mention there is a thing called Explorer's Mode, which turns off all of the ticking clock stuff.
I think it just slows it down dramatically to the point where it becomes more like the time still passes. But I mean, I've been using it, so I could say,
yeah,
I haven't been watching exactly whether people's clocks are ticking. Like, I need to look more carefully at the numbers. But my understanding is that it just dramatically slows that down. I will say for myself, when I first heard about the ticking clock mechanic and then when I played it and realized the implications of it, I instantly turned on Explorer's Mode. I instantly turned that mode on because that gave me so much anxiety, which I realize is the point. I realize the idea is you're supposed to become attached to these characters and have to make tough choices about who lives and who dies. The problem is I was not ready to do that. And some of that is like gameplay stuff. Like, I didn't know which characters would be most useful to me. But some of that is also like, I'm not going to let my little like fairy creature that follows me around everywhere die. That's nuts.
Yeah.
But why would I also save the shopkeeper? And then I learned the shopkeeper has this whole backstory. It was like giving me anxiety. And not only that, it ties into the gameplay. Cause like, as you're, let's say you go and fight a boss and you die a bunch of times, you're still reviving, but time is progressing. So you're losing all of that time for all these people. Yeah. So that adds even more to the anxiety of it. That was not the game I wanted to play. There might be people that want to play that game. Not for me.
It's me. It is big time me. There also are two modes. There's one that is pure anxiety mode, which is the hard mode where time really, I mean, people are just dropping like flies. And then there's kind of the normal mode, which I feel like so far, bad things happen, but I feel like I'm going to see the end of the game.
Have you like lost people?
Yes. I mean, I've been very careful with the people that I don't want to lose. But I think the thing that I'm most worried about right now is like myself, because I think effectively saved three people. So you collect this dust, and you can give it to characters, and it gives them like a heart each time. And if you fill up like the four heart containers, they will give you a reward that is a pretty big benefit. I won't spoil what those rewards are, but I mean, this isn't like, oh, you know, 10% increase on your attacks. It's like
meaningful. I'll give you one, because they actually give it to you in a tutorial. They basically say like, hey, if you max this out, instead of having to go to these save points to change your equipment loadout, you can do it anywhere on the map. That's like an example of like a pretty significant upgrade that you get.
I would say that is the least useful one that I have unlocked right now, to give you an idea of just how much better they can get. But yeah, when you lose people, they effectively just go off. I was wondering if you fight them? I have not had to fight them, but there are characters in the game who are like a type of robot, like they served a function in society before this happened, where you will meet friendly versions of them, and then you will meet other versions of that type of robot that are unsighted. So you'll come across robots not knowing at first, like, wait, are they an enemy? Or are they like a shopkeeper? What am I doing here? I mean, the game rules. It's so smart. And the big thing worth mentioning about this game is it was made by two people, which I can't believe.
Yeah, that's wild.
It's wild. It's by the studio Studio Pixelpunk. It's two LGBT Brazilian game devs, and it feels so solid. It's like it just feels so complete in a way that very few indie games do, especially with the kind of swings that it's taking. The other thing that I'll say about, you know, extremely to the creator's credit, the game has all of this going on, but the world that they've actually created is full of femme-identifying characters, of queer relationships, like the gamut of body types and disabilities. And it's very interesting that they've created this world of robots that it is like the breath of humanity, right? Yeah. Like you get the sense that for humanity's flaws, they actually, because you don't come across a lot of humans in this game, they actually gave a lot to the robots that they created in terms of like, you know, capturing the full experience of human life, which makes this story so much richer when you both know that humans are the villains, but also in creating these creatures, these robots, they gave them so much, which creates, I don't know, it's just a really interesting friction.
Do you think narratively, I'm going to get letters. Do you think narratively this is a stronger, and again, I'm not talking about production value or anything, just narrative, stronger than Nier Automata?
I don't.
Because they're very similar.
Yes, I don't, but it's not that I don't think it's stronger. It's that they're just doing very, very, very different things. So like Nier Automata for me feels like a creator with kind of at the top of his game, like mm-hmm. with Yoko Taro, yeah. and with just more resources than he's ever had.
Sure.
And he's kind of done like rough drafts of the game, like at that point, at least two other times before it, with Drakengard and Nier Replicant, right?
Yeah.
So when I play Nier Automata, I get the sense of like, wow, this is just, it's stuffing all of these ideas into one thing to the point that it can't really contain it. And I actually think Nier Automata is messier than this game.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think it is too.
This feels like a very singular, we have the story we want to tell.
It doesn't feel like there's a lot of fat on this game. Like
no.
Everything is very precise and there for a reason. And with Nier, when I played it, like as much as I really, really loved the like bigger parts of it, there was a lot of like side extra stuff that just felt unnecessary and tacked on.
I think this is a trillion times more accessible than Nier Automata. And yeah. I also think if you're playing Nier just for what it has to say about the idea of humans as gods creating robots and what it means for robots to have sentience, this does that better and simpler. Yeah. I just think Nier is also doing so much else on top of that, that, you know, like I can't really dock it against it. But it's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, it's definitely some similarities. And I think people who have played Nier will check this out and like be pretty amazed that there are so many analogs to it.
Well, and even the like play of it, like the action style of it has some Nier elements. There's an upgrade that is particularly Nier-like. You can do chips like you could in Nier, and chips are these you know, little slots that you can fill in with like you get an extra, I'm trying to think of like,
you want more stamina
you don't lose stamina from running, stuff like that,
like passive perks,
faster reload, yeah,
and that works exactly how it does in Nier, which is to say you can pay for upgrades to have more memory space to store more chips. I'd be stunned if the developers didn't play Nier, to be honest.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, I have to imagine. Before we kind of wrap up Unsighted, and I have a feeling we'll talk about it more either on Besties, because I know Justin is playing, or at the Game of the Year part. How do you feel about the kind of dungeons and the abilities that you unlock for each dungeon? You know, like in Zelda, you have the bomb and the boomerang. And this game has its own particular versions of that. And I was curious what you thought.
Yeah, I had I was able to play through the first dungeon, and I was just starting the second dungeon, but hadn't unlocked that ability yet. But the first dungeon was the, you get the boomerang that can like carry elements, right? So it can basically move fire from one place to another, which I think has been done in a Zelda game as well, which I thought was fine. I was not super taken by that dungeon. I thought the boss fight was like very epic and impressive, but the actual like puzzle solving, I think in general is not my favorite thing. There's a genre called Sakuban. It's like a Japanese origin genre of like box pushing. There's a lot of box pushing in this game. I don't know if that lessens over time, but early on, there's a lot of box pushing. Doesn't really do it for me. I do like the combat in those dungeons though. So, but I don't know, maybe what is the next ability? Maybe
so that's more you get a gun that fires ice grenades effectively, and when they land in water, they create temporary platforms, which becomes, as you can probably imagine, where you're at in the game, extremely useful.
Yeah, sure.
And also, the grenades can like break certain stuff because it freezes it. So, pretty cool in that it does two different things in terms of solving puzzles. And yeah, I think you're right. I think the dungeons are a bit simple and the puzzles are a bit simple, but I also wonder if that is intentional because of the anxiety of the clock. Like, if you had really challenging combat or really challenging puzzles, plus the anxiety of, oh my gosh, every second counts and I can't figure out this dang thing, that would maybe be too much.
I don't know about that. I think if that were the case, the bosses wouldn't be as hard as they are. And that first boss is like, no joke, legit difficult.
Did you find out how to get the recipe to make extra health packs? You didn't. You definitely
the syringes.
The syringes. Yeah.
Yeah, I got that, but it was after beating the first boss.
Okay, I cannot imagine.
It was extremely difficult. Yeah, I was throwing all sorts of perks and yeah.
Yes. So early on, this is a tip for people. Before we go, if you at the very beginning of the game, if you go left, there's a city. I'm sure you can find a guide for this too online, but there's a little area that will have a character who will sell you a blueprint to make health packs from like materials that you find all over the place, and you find tons of this stuff. Make a beeline for that before you do pretty much anything.
Yeah, that's funny having that you can do that so early.
Yeah. I just stumbled across it by accident. They also, you can get just a permanent second health vessel. I personally have not worried about that just because it's so cheap for me to make, you know, temporary ones.
Yeah.
But I, after beating the first dungeon, that was my immediate thought was, oh my gosh, I don't know how anybody would do this without that ability.
That's funny because they actually do prompt you after beating the first dungeon. Hey, you should go over here and this person will give you more syringes, which would have been useful before, but oh well.
Cool. Well, like I said, I think we'll talk about this a little bit more. Do you have any other thoughts on it before we...
No. I think it's great. It is on Game Pass. So if you subscribe to Game Pass, you could check it out there. I know you've been playing on Switch, which is probably where, if I had to choose, I would have played it there, but I actually have been playing on Xbox. So also good, but having it portable is probably really nice.
Yeah, and it runs so well on Switch, which was a problem that we had with CrossCode back when that launched.
Yeah, I think
that got patched and got fixed. But yeah, if you're worried about that, let it not be a concern. Okay, on the other side of this break, we're going to keep talking about things that are on Game Pass. There has been a bunch of stuff dropped on the service, some kind of besties favorites. So we're going to look back at those, and I'm specifically going to talk about XO1, which is a game I think you'll see bubbling up in the games community over the next few weeks. So we will talk more soon. Okay, Fresh. So, do you know anything about XO1?
I think I saw a screenshot of it. It kind of looked like Star Fox.
Kind of.
Just based on the screenshot. I don't know what the gameplay is.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've seen these lately, but there's been an increase in Marble games on PC. Like, games that are 3D games where you are a marvel and you're just moving across the world, like trying to navigate spaces or solve puzzles.
I hate it.
You hate it? Oh, yeah.
I don't like Marvel games.
Well, so this isn't a Marvel game in that sense. I initially saw the video and the screens of this, and I was like, oh, okay, it's like a puzzle-solving game. This is a momentum game. So you are effectively a marble, but
it, am I making the Star Fox thing up? Maybe I'm just thinking of a totally different
game. Well, no, I don't think you are, because you're a marble, but you're not actually a marble. You are some sort of alien spaceship, and I do not, I'll be real with y'all, I do not understand the story. I really wanted to like whatever kind of like Arrival sci-fi story this is going for. For the life of me, I can't figure it out. Some astronauts are on Jupiter. They had to eject after seeing a strange light. And now suddenly you are zipping across like the galaxy in this marble. And all that, whatever, that doesn't matter. What matters is that you are effectively going through all a ton of alien environments in a marble that can turn into a disc. And when you don't press down on a button, you are, I think, like 10 times lighter than gravity or something like that.
Sure.
And then when you do press down, you are 10 times heavier. So if you're going downhill and you push the trigger, it really sends you down the hill. And then if you let go, going up an incline, you like fly up it because you're extremely light, which will shoot you up into the air. And then once you're in the air, another button allows you to change your ball into a disc so that you can kind of float.
It sounds like, what was the game? Not Flappy Bird, but...
Tiny Wings.
Tiny Wings.
Yes.
It sounds like Tiny
Wings. It's like Journey meets 3D Tiny Wings, where you are going up and down hills. And the game's only about 2.5 to 3 hours. And your goal is just to, you see a beacon of light in the distance and you need to get to it. And the meat of the game is the changing environment. So,
yeah,
you know, you might have just an environment that's hills, but then you might have an environment that has lots of water. And because you're a disc, you can actually skip on the water, or you can go, you know, plunge really deep into it. And then that'll shoot you really high up in the air. So you're using the physics of these different environments. You know, another is a gaseous planet. Using these physics to propel yourself where you gotta go. Incredibly simple.
Yeah, it sounds cool.
Feels great. Looks, at times, like one of the prettiest games I've seen this year.
Wow.
At other times, like a PlayStation 1 game.
Okay. Is that intentional or is that...
I don't know. I've been trying to figure it out. There is, most of the time, I was like, oh, I think this is intentional. It's just going for kind of a rough... aesthetic, but there are trees in this game that look like they like bought one tree off of some asset package, and then there's like 10 of them.
They're not using speed tree, is what you're saying.
They're not using speed tree. It just looks really funny, and I don't know what they're going for. I dig it. It's cool to look at, but it's kind of jarring when you go from what kind of looks like realistic almost alien skies, you know, like you're in the clouds and it's like, wow, I'm like in the clouds of this alien planet. And then you like throw yourself to Earth and you're like, oh my gosh, what Nintendo 64 game have I found myself in?
Textures are hard, man.
Yeah, I mean, making video games seems really difficult. That's kind of like what I took away from playing this game, is I don't think I would be good at making a video game, even one as simple as this. And I think like that's the hook of this and a lot of these Marvel games. I don't mean this is going to sound like an insult, and I really don't mean it that way, but it feels kind of like a student game in the sense that it's such a like simple premise of make the marble roll to the point.
Yeah.
And then it's decorated with all of the other good ideas. You know, like it's, you know, playing with physics and a little bit of the sci-fi story that it gives meaning to something that if like you actually just stop and look at it is I'm rolling a marble north.
Yeah, I think Journey does the same thing where it really elevates a relatively simple input system.
Yeah, which itself was a follow-up to a student game, right?
Journey. Flower. Right?
Flower. I guess Flower wasn't a student
game. Oh, no, you're talking about the underwater one.
Yeah. So yeah, a very cool game. I'm curious for you, has there been anything else that you have been playing on Game Pass?
Yeah, I mentioned on the Besties Unpacking, which is a game about unpacking your room. I know a number of people have really, really enjoyed it. If you haven't checked that out, highly recommend it. I also wanted to talk about Moonglow Bay.
Oh, yeah.
Which is...
fishing?
It's a fishing game. It is basically... the closest I can describe it to is like very Stardew Valley, but instead of being like a farmer, you're a fisher person. And you can basically make money and meet a variety of people throughout the town as you improve your fishing skills and find new fish and all sorts of things like that. Gorgeous, like low poly aesthetic, really great soundtrack. It's just like a very vibey game where you just sort of like relax and chill out. I really like, after you go fishing, you actually have to prepare the fish. So there's these like little cooking mini games that you do with the fish you've caught. If you like games where you like make a store and then get more productive at running that store, this is definitely checking that box.
Is it boring? And I don't mean boring in like a mean negative way. I mean like, oh, you know, this is a game where nothing really happens and you kind of zen.
I mean, there's... I don't know if you would describe Stardew Valley the same way. I think a lot...
Yeah,
I don't know that it's quite as... I mean, Stardew Valley is like one of the best games ever made, so I don't want to like challenge things against that. I think it is very smart in the way that it evolves and like shows you different things throughout the town and different fish to catch and stuff like that. I didn't find it boring. I haven't spent enough time with it, but what I played, I thought was pretty interesting.
I feel ashamed because the other two games that I wanted to flag are like the very opposite of this and will make me sound like, I don't know, you know, just like...
a dope.
Yeah, dope. Like, so I wanted to talk about My Friend Pedro.
I really like this game.
I do too.
It came out a couple years ago.
It came out a couple years ago on Switch. And I think maybe...
And PC. It was
PC, yeah. And it's basically a John Woo like simulator. You are this character, it's a 2D side-scrolling action shooter where you jump into rooms and you can slow down time and perform all sorts of chaotic gun ballet action sequences, you know, diving across the room and grabbing onto a hook that ziplines you over the heads of all these mobsters while you, you know, take them all out. It's very silly and kind of messy. I don't know how much they fixed it up. There are some driving action sequences that were particularly messy on the Nintendo Switch, but this is exactly the type of game that I love to see on Game Pass, because if you're paying like full price for it, it can be a little tough to recommend to everybody because of that, right? Like, I personally think it's worth the rough edges, but you know, your mileage may vary for that sort of thing. But when it's just a matter of the cost of downloading it, not so bad. So yeah, I really liked that game. Did you end up finishing that, or did you just put a few hours into it?
No, I just put a few hours in. And when I played it on Switch, it didn't run great. So I kind of do want to try it again on Xbox just to like see it run. I'm sure it's amazing at 60 FPS. I also would say, like, you talked about John Woo. I think it's the closest that I've seen a game get to, like, a Deadpool action simulator.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, it's very silly. And not just, like, the graphics of it, although the graphics are very silly. There's also, like, you, like, throw a pan into a room, and then you shoot the pan, and the pan makes all the bullets reflect all over the room in, like, goofy ways. So that, I think... I don't know if that appeals to you at all. It's definitely worth checking out. I did actually enjoy what I played, but I remember thinking like, wish this ran a little bit better.
Yeah, I just realized that there might be younger listeners who don't know who John Woo is. So just quickly, John Woo was a director who made some American action films like Broken Arrow and Face Off and Mission Impossible 2. But his masterwork, which is like weirdly hard to find, is a film called Hard Boiled, and it is unbelievable. If you are in the market for just basically the inspiration for so much of the John Wick knockoffs of today, it all goes back to this film, Hard Boiled.
Yeah, any movie where you see someone diving in slow motion while shooting a gun basically comes from this.
Yeah, yeah, it is fantastic. The other kind of silly action thing is Kill It With Fire, which I think I maybe brought as like a honorable mentions to a besties. But this is a game where there are spiders hidden throughout different environments, like starting with a house, and you try to kill them with increasingly elaborate weapons from shuriken? Samurai stars.
Yeah.
Thank you. And to, like, obviously fire to other stuff.
How realistic are the spiders?
The spiders are not realistic. They're quite cartoony, but if you have arachnophobia, I still wouldn't play it, because a lot of the game is not knowing where they are. So you're opening closets or drawers and they jump out at you.
Yeah, hard pass.
Yeah. So that, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I know that that is a big problem for a number of people. Any other stuff on there that you want to mention?
Just two more real quick. Dicey Dungeons and The Forgotten City. These are both games that we've talked about on Besties before, so I won't go at length. But if you like, Dicey Dungeons is like a puzzle RPG, kind of like a deck building RPG, dice game, which is very cool. And Forgotten City, we talked about at length for a full episode. Great narrative, like set in ancient Rome. So both are excellent and well worth checking out.
Cool. I think it's time for some listener mail to talk about traditions. Do you want to just, we can take these back and forth?
Sure.
Cool.
What was the prompt?
I'll let you take the first one. So the prompt is, what are some of your favorite holiday traditions around gaming, right? We just had Thanksgiving. We got the full holidays on the way. You know, what brings you joy in the gaming world during this time? So you want to take the first one?
Sure. This one comes from Cameron. My biggest holiday gaming tradition has been playing through the Tomorrow Corporation game Little Inferno every Christmas since it's come out. It's, in my opinion, it is the closest video game equivalent to the fun but moving qualities of classic Christmas animations. It's really interesting. I remember I loved the game that came before that, which was World of Goo. That was like their big breakout game. And then this game came out and I remember trying it, and I remember you like set stuff on fire, but it never really clicked for me. I'm not saying it's bad. I just never got to the point where it was more interesting than that. But I do know that it does get to that point. So maybe it's where I gotta check it out if Cameron likes it so much.
That was exactly my reaction. I feel like it's been on that kind of list of, I really should go back and play that game. They make good games.
Yeah.
This one is from Old Gamers Almanac. Our group of friends will all travel back into our hometown during the holidays, and we make a point of to play weirdly complicated Halo 3 Zombies custom matches, and more importantly, suffering the annoying process of getting Chaos Theory's Spies versus Mercs working.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
both of those check in a lot of boxes for me. I'll say that I played Chaos Theory, that is Splinter Cell Chaos Theory, had an amazing Spies versus Mercenaries multiplayer mode, where it was like this asymmetrical multiplayer. That was just tremendous. Like, that was my college years, to date myself for a little bit. But man, so much fun. Halo local like LAN custom matches, also spectacular. And supported right now in Halo Infinite, which is also very cool.
Okay, you take the next one.
Okay, next one comes from Kevin. For many years, my parents owned a Wii U. Very nice parents. One of the few parents that owned a Wii U.
Kept Nintendo just alive.
Just to play the Game & Wario minigame called Sketch, which was just a multiplayer Pictionary game that we would trot out every Thanksgiving and Christmas, everyone passing around the gamepad after dinner. It's pretty good, to be honest. That's great. That's very cool. That I think the more convenient version of that is probably one of the Jackbox games. I forget what they call their Pictionary version, but
yeah.
I mean, their Pictionary is Pictionary. Like, it's almost always more or less the same idea, and it's very cool that y'all have sort of landed on the one game that you trot out and giving a reason to turn the Wii U on, which certainly been quite a while since I've had an excuse.
I love when, I feel like this happens with parents a lot, when people fall in love with video games and they're outside of the video game world, so they don't know that that video game is now irrelevant. And they just continue living in bliss, thinking other people must do the same thing.
Yeah.
And my most recent example, I was in Austin a couple weeks ago with my parents, and I stopped by this retro game shop in Austin, and my dad immediately made a beeline for the front desk and was asking them where their Kinect games are, because he loves to play Kinect with their neighbors.
Sure.
And he's like, oh, I love this. And he's like, what Kinect games do you have for Xbox One?
Oh,
and
man.
They're like, oh, well, not a lot. And he's like, well, I know that everything's backwards compatible. Can I play my Kinect games on Xbox One?
So savvy.
And he's like, they're like, no, that was not their priority. And you can tell these, I felt bad for everyone involved in this conversation.
Yeah.
And probably because it didn't need to happen, because I could have just talked to him through all of this. But he was so crushed. And he had not played these games for like 6 months, because their 360 broke.
Oh, no.
So then he was like, oh, I now need to buy an Xbox 360 to like...
Well, an Xbox One, right?
No, a 360. Because most
Kinect,
of the...
Oh, yeah, Kinect was on 360 as well. Oh, man.
Yeah, that's where all of it was. Yeah,
it's
and
so
long. Xbox One didn't play most of the Kinect stuff. It only played like the new Kinect games.
Oh, right, the new Kinect, yeah.
I know.
Wow. It's been so long.
But like, yes, watching him process all of this was like... It was sad, but it was also very charming that there is somebody out there who really loves Kinect. And it, and still, like, I had seen him do this years ago. We'll talk to his neighbors as if it still exists and that they should go buy one. it rules.
That's incredible. Has he seen the famous video of showing the foot?
No, it would be lost on him. Yeah,
okay.
Actually, he would probably be impressed. Okay, one other listener mail before we go. This one from Rose. When I was little, my dad had a stroke, and that left him physically disabled, so we could never travel anywhere for holidays. Every Christmas, Easter, birthday, etc., we have a tradition now of buying and playing a new multiplayer game as a way to spend time together as a family. I think that's really
awesome.
Nice. Yeah.
No, that's great. This is like my, you know, I had a child 5 months ago. This is my vision of the future, is like, fine. There's a number of multiplayer games that my wife will not play with me. The idea, you know what, fringe benefit of having a child is I can finally do some multiplayer. But the idea that everyone in the family gets together to play like a multiplayer game, that's awesome. I want more of that, please. I think that's great. So long as everyone behaves and doesn't get angry at each other.
Yeah, well, and I know I was just goofing on the Kinect stuff, but why my dad is obsessed with it is, you know, he is older. He lives near a bunch of older people who have their own disabilities or inabilities to play certain games, or just have never come in contact with a video game controller. So being able to like pull that out and have something that everybody just plays together during, you know, the 4th of July is really special. And I imagine in this case, that's such like a lovely tradition that, you know, it's sad to not be able to travel, but being able to bond in this way, it just rules.
Yeah, that's great. It makes me wonder when the next, like, Kinect or Wii Sports equivalent will happen that, like, captures that audience of people that never, ever play games, but because it's so easy to just, like, pick up, it suddenly does.
Yeah. I think it's like, it's there's kind of like two threads there. There's that, there's the accessibility part of it for the audience I was talking about with like my dad. And then there's just this multiplayer audience of, you know, we didn't talk a lot about, you know, the new Mario Party. But I'm just so glad those games exist for this sort of scenario, right? For the like, that couch multiplayer continues to survive in a world that seems to be determined to switch almost entirely to online.
Yeah, no, for sure. And more systems are actually supporting like simulated couch multiplayer, where even if the game doesn't have online multiplayer, you can connect. I know it's supported on Steam and PlayStation. You can connect over the internet and it'll be like someone is joining your game locally. So
yeah,
it's great to see as well.
I love it. Okay, that's pretty much it. Now the part of the episode where we recommend one thing that pretty much is never a video game.
Yeah, I hate this segment because it's always like Chris Plant coming in with like, well, Aristotle's, you know, he wrote on the wall and then there was a documentary about it that was 36 hours long and you could only get it on this one streaming service.
Oh no, I hate what I'm about to recommend today.
Anyway, I'll start with my approachable recommendation, which is Nora from Queens. You might know it as Awkwafina's show on Comedy Central. It is now, the second season is now streaming on HBO Max. If you haven't watched it at all, it's an excellent like comedy about sort of a woman dealing with arrested development of like being a millennial and having difficulty finding a job and stuff like that. But also, Awkwafina is very, very funny, extremely talented, was great in Shang-Chi. I just watched that as well. But I love this show. It's massively creative. It's in the same way that, like, I think Broad City really took risks with its episode structure and format and stuff like that. I just watched the time travel episode. That was spectacular.
Oh my gosh.
Highly recommend it. That is streaming on HBO Max. And now, put on your TED Talk hats.
Oh my gosh. So I went and saw this movie called Labyrinth of Cinema.
Yeah.
I went and saw it at this art theater in Santa Ana that I love.
Was it crowded in there?
You know what? So that's actually part of the story. So first, it's directed by Obayashi, who did, you actually probably are familiar with one of his movies, House. That like weird 70s, 80s horror movie from Japan.
It does ring a bell.
It's like very psychedelic. It became popular in America like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is his final film before he passed away. It is a 3-hour movie.
Yeah.
About the history of cinema and also the history of war in Japan from like the shogunate era to like just after World War II. Knowing that, and also it shot kind of like comedy French New Wave, like truly bizarre. There is a UFO that is flying through time that is turning a movie theater in Hiroshima into like a portal into the world of movies. I mean, like very weird.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about weed movies versus weed games. This is a weed movie. So I know all of this, right? And I'm sitting down, and this theater was playing two movies. One was Fantastic Mr. Fox, and the other was this. And I get there 10 minutes before it starts. I am the only person in the theater. And this couple comes in right before the movie starts, sits behind, like, two rows behind me. And they're like, oh, you know, it was so hard to decide between this or Fantastic Mr. Fox. And the woman's like, yeah, you know, I don't really like art films, so I hope that this isn't like that. Like, mm-hmm. The only art movie I've ever liked was The English Patient.
Oh, no.
And he's like, well, I think this will be really fun. And kind of like, the trailer looked breezy. And she's like, yeah, I don't really like movies that are over an hour and a half anyway.
Oh, no.
And I'm just, I felt like I needed to turn around and be like, turn back. You know, there's no shame. Fantastic Mr. Fox is an absolutely fantastic movie. Go see it. Go see that Fox.
And 90 minutes long, even better.
And 90 minutes long. They lasted, to their credit, 20 minutes before very audibly deciding to leave.
Yeah.
Which I completely respect.
Have you seen the trailer? Does the trailer look breezy?
The trailer for this?
Yeah.
It actually looks really fun. which I don't think that they were deluding themselves there. Anyway, it's on Mubi if you want to watch it. I think if you are the type of person who really likes getting in Wikipedia holes and likes to like learn, like this is a movie that I felt like I was just learning so much. And it's a movie that, despite all of the pretentious sounding stuff, is very funny and inventive. The way that Obayashi does makes a lot of his films is he uses copious amounts of green screen. So it looks kind of like a blend between the Star Wars prequels and like collage, you know, like where you like cut stuff out of magazines and paste over each other. It looks like moving collage. It's really cool. And again, it's on Mubi. So if you wanted to
is
try
that a thing? Mubi? What is that?
Mubi, M-U-B-I. It's a streaming service.
Okay.
But it's like Criterion Channel, but somehow even more snooty. But I found a way. I want to recommend these things because I don't know. I feel like we have a very, you know, small but curious audience, and if like five people go and see this, I'm giving you shit. It's fair shit. It's very fair shit to give. I was gonna recommend, you know, something like I don't know. Well, damn it, I was gonna say Tokyo Godfathers, but that's not gonna help me out. That's like also.
You're gonna bring Meet the Clumps next week. It'll be great.
I mean, Tim Allen is fantastic in that film. You know, like a fox. I think we did it. I think we did the episode. To recap the games that we talked about this week, we talked about Unsighted, which was the bulk of the first half of the episode. I talked about XO1, the kind of like Marble sci-fi game. Marble, not Marvel. Unpacking Moonglow Bay, My Friend Pedro, Dicey Dungeons, Kill It With Fire, and The Forgotten City. All of those games are on Game Pass, including Unsighted, if you want to check any of them out, which is really cool. You recommend people check out Nora from Queens, which I completely support. I think is wonderful. I recommend Labyrinth of Cinema, which is on Mubi, which I don't know if that is a like, hey, everybody go out and do it. But if my description made you curious, maybe give it a try. And let us know what you think if you do.
And you're gonna bring a dummy pick next week, next time.
Unquestionably, I am gonna bring like reruns of The Price is Right.
I love it.
Do we have any plans for next week? Or not next week? Or next episode?
In 2 weeks. I don't know. We will be in Game of the Year territory, but it's maybe we'll highlight some of the picks that will not make the final cut, but are definitely still worth playing.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Cool. Well, thank you for making time to chat, and thank you, listeners, for making time to listen. We are so thankful for you for being part of this weird experiment that is Resties during this extremely busy holiday season.
Thank you.
So that's it for the Resties. That's it for the Resties, where we celebrate the best of the rest of the festivest.
Goodbye.
Bye.